This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. Glad to have you with us. And in this part of the show, we also will be talking with John Eisenberg. He's a sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun. He's the author of a number of books, one that we'll be talking about here this morning, which is titled The Great Match Race, When North Met South in America's First Sports Spectacle. The book is just recently out and published by Houghton Mifflin. He's written a number of others, and including another one that's about horse racing, about a horse in particular, Native Dancer, Hero of a Golden Age. And that book is now out there, if you're interested. In 2003, his commentary was part of a radio broadcast that earned an Eclipse Award. That's the highest honor given for coverage of horse racing. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, 800-222-9455 anyplace else. And that will bring you right here to this program. If you have questions, you can come right here to the show. A pledge is not required. That would be nice, but it is not required to call in. Mr. Eisenberg, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. Well, I guess one of the things that makes this story interesting and is significant is that, as I understand it, in the United States at this time, there really wasn't much in the way of spectator sport. There weren't big things, sporting events, where large numbers of people turned out just to watch.
Well, that's right. And as the title says, this is really America's first sports spectacle, this race that I wrote about. There was no football. Football wouldn't be invented until the 1869 or so. Baseball was not until the 1850s. Basketball, really the 1890s, I believe, is when the peach basket went up. No tennis, no golf. Really, boxing wasn't even that popular then. It was starting to get popular in England. So there were really no sports in America. I mean, life was hard, and people... It was a largely agrarian society, and people worked hard, and there wasn't a lot of leisure time like some of us have today. And so there just really nothing was set up for sports at all. And really, the only sport that attracted people and sort of had a life of its own was horse racing. And horse racing had been around actually a long time. I mean, since the first track in America was 1665, and in New York and throughout colonial era, and really as long as there'd been settlers, people would just line up their horses and see who was the fastest. So there was a history of horse racing, and as the country came forward in the 1700s and in the early 1800s, it sort of ebbed and flowed from time to time. But in the 1820s, when I'm writing about it, it was quite popular, and there was a circuit of tracks, most of them on the East Coast, Virginia, most of them in the South. And they were nice tracks, nice places, and there was a little schedule of racing meetings, and so there was a nice little horse race society, but it was the only sport that there was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that as long as people have been riding horses, they rode them competitively. You know, you can imagine sometime in the dim and distant past, some guy saying, "My horse is faster than yours," and the other guy saying, "Oh yeah, I want to bet," and there
right.
He had it right there.
Right.
So I'm sure that people were doing that and doing competitive games and stuff with horses. So that people had been doing that for a long time. Well, was there, and I would think though that because the South perhaps was a little bit more of a rural culture, that there, and this is something that does perhaps, if you're going to do it at a high level, require some money, that there would be more of a horse culture in the South than there was in the North. Is that true?
Oh, that's absolutely true, for a number of reasons. The Southerners, well, they had better weather. They had richer soil. They had more of a rural society as opposed to the North was increasingly industrial. And in the North, people were beginning to gather in cities. And probably the biggest reason in the North was more conservative. I mean, you had the Puritans, you had the Quakers. And this is going back to colonial era and after that. So, and they really frowned on racing, on the gambling, and they thought it was sinful and it would ruin society. And in the South, which was inhabited almost entirely by people who followed the Church of England, And the Church of England tolerated racing. And and I smiled on racing. So there were many reasons why horse racing thrived in the South and barely existed in the North. And the better horsemen, the better horses, the better breeding, the better everything was in the South for a long time.
So that might lead someone who was involved with horses in the South to think that no matter what, any Southern horse any day should be able to beat any Northern horse.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that is a total, they were arrogant would not even be the word. They barely even recognized the fact that there was racing in the North. And you know what? That was sort of understandable because there barely was racing in the North. From 1802 to 1821, racing was outlawed in the state of New York. And it was outlawed, from 1810 to 1819, I think, in Pennsylvania. And there was very little breeding, and none of the breeding that was done was for racing. Well, virtually none of it was for racing. They were breeding to improve the breed of horses. Horses were used to pull wagons and power mills, and they were used for work. In the South, it was entirely different. The South, they actually had a racehorse breeding society to a small degree, and it was, of course, the wealthy tobacco planters, for the most part, just controlled and these were slaveholding people, and they controlled the breed and the bloodlines and bred some pretty nice horses. And so, yes, they wouldn't even, there was very little racing in the North, and the Southern people, when there was in the North, the Southerners would not even deign to travel north to race at northern tracks, such as they were. The northerners who were into horse racing had to go to the South. So they were truly displaced. Any northern horseman had to go to the South to race against the best in America.
Well, there certainly was at least one great northern horse. That was that, and would have had a reputation in the South, hence the challenge. And this was Eclipse. Tell us about this horse.
Well, Eclipse. Really, too. The story of Eclipse is a breeding story. There was in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War, which pretty much wiped out any sort of thoroughbred breeding that had gone on in America. The horsemen of America slowly started to import thoroughbred sires again from England. They all came from England, and these were the tobacco planters, sort of starting over. And the vast majority of them went to the South. These were Southern guys. One thoroughbred sire went to the North. The sire's name was Messenger. And Messenger was a small horse that landed and wound up in Philadelphia and sort of circulated in the North a little bit. And what few people, a lot of people bred to Messenger just to sire work horses, but a few people bred to race, and in Long Island, really, there was this wealthy mill owner, and he bred to Messenger with a top female runner in the North, and they produced this horse, Eclipse. Eclipse was, from the get-go, just a majestic animal, unnamed at first. And the mill owner that owned him sort of, they didn't do anything with him for 2 or 3 years. They just let him grow in the fields. And they did name him Eclipse, and that in itself was putting a lot of pressure on the horse, not that the horse would feel it, but the greatest thoroughbred in history at that point was an English horse named Eclipse. Mm-hmm. It had been bred during an eclipse of the sun in 1764, I believe, and so they named that horse Eclipse, and he was the gold standard. He raced 18 times, won them all, and the jockey never used his whip, and he would win races by a quarter of a mile. And anyone who was into horses knew of the English Eclipse. So by naming this American horse, they kind of called him American Eclipse. They really held him to a high standard that many horses couldn't make, but this horse could. And he started racing and winning, and he beat all the northern horses very easily. And then the Southerners started taking a run at him. They built a nice track on Long Island, which was the site of the race, the Great Match Race eventually. But before that, there were a couple of intersectional races. The Southerners would start to come up when the Northerners were trying to get racing going again. Then they would hold some racing meetings, and they would bring up some Southern trainers and nice horses. And they would challenge Eclipse. And over a period of several years, Eclipse won four races against three different Southern horses, pretty good horses. And so the Southerners were getting increasingly mad that they were the horsemen. They were the great horse people, and they knew everything, and yet they didn't even acknowledge the Northern Horse Society. But here, suddenly the North had this horse that the Southerners couldn't beat.
Did this, it's tempting to use this as a kind of a North-South battle by proxy. Did it indeed have that sort of dimension, that it wasn't perhaps just one group of horse people versus another, that it was very clearly Southern horse people and Southerners versus Northern horse people and Northerners?
Oh, absolutely. The whole dynamic of the period leading up to the Great Match Race, which was in 1823, and the Great Match Race itself, that period of time in the days beforehand, it was very much a North-South dynamic. And this is the 1820s, of course, we're almost 40 years before the Civil War. However, it was a period of time, and I did quite a bit of research into this and found it quite interesting. I mean, it is a period of time where the nation is just starting to come apart. And as a matter of fact, you could argue, really, as I sort of did after reading up on it, I mean, it's debatable whether the nation ever really came together after winning Revolutionary War, gaining independence. I mean, there was very clearly a North versus South dynamic in the first half century of this country. The electoral votes, if you look at them from some of the elections that were right around the turn of the century, with Thomas Jefferson involved, it breaks down totally on regional lines, the northern candidates versus the southern candidates. North and the South actually didn't agree on a whole lot. They were sort of joined in business. The Southerners were growing crops, and the Northerners were sort of the more commercial people that would sell them. And so they were joined on business, but that was it. So, and of course, the issue of slavery was a huge one. And 1820, just in the period leading up to the race, that was when the Missouri Compromise unfolded in Congress in Washington, which was an argument strictly over slavery and how to admit states to the Union, whether they would be slaveholding states or not. America was very much a slaveholding nation at that time. But the northern politicians at that period sort of drew the line finally and began to fight back against the Southerners, who were used to having their own way. And so that was set up the debate in Congress with Missouri Compromise, which actually freed the entire Louisiana Purchase, as it turned out, and started the nation towards eradicating slavery. But all that had happened, and passions were very hot in the early 1820s. So as a precursor to the Great Match Race, the North and the South were eyeing each other, I would say, to put it in very general terms, were eyeing each other for the first time with sort of a raised eyebrow, like maybe we're having a little problem here.
Yeah. So here, obviously, the stage is set. There already is political rivalry, emotional rivalry involving the North and the South, and then among people who raise horses and race horses, there was also this matter of pride in who produced the best horses. And you talked about the fact that there was this very successful Northern horse, Eclipse, that run races against a number of Southern horses and won them all. So apparently, finally, there was at least one man. This is a man from North Carolina who was a horse trainer, who apparently he just had it. And he thought, we must defeat this horse. We must beat Eclipse. And so he issued this challenge to the people who owned Eclipse to race against, as they say, a horse to be named later, some Southern horse. They were going to race, and they were going to have this race at this place. And not only would there be a lot of pride here at stake, but there was, for this time, a very large purse offered for this race.
Yes, the stakes were $20,000 a side, which is an enormous amount of money back then. I mean, that's an entire estate, would have funded an entire estate. And the Southerner who put the challenge together was a man by the name of William Ransom Johnson. And he was the greatest horseman of his day, far and away, sort of a horse whisperer type, an uncanny sort of knack with horses. He was, as you said, born in North Carolina. He wound up moving to Virginia, where there was better racing. The best racing in the country was in Virginia at that time. And he was a very charismatic and dynamic figure. a state-level politician in his own right and a smart businessman and just sort of a cunning guy. He was so preeminent as a horseman that his nickname was the Napoleon of the Turf, which, of course, one of the great nicknames ever, and that was a high compliment at that point in time. That was, shortly after Napoleon had lorded over Europe. And so the Napoleon of the Turf was a great horseman. At one point, his horses won 61 of 63 races over a two-year period. He was so dominant that tracks would tell him, please don't come. We don't bring your horses. We want to give our money to someone else, and it's really no fun when you come. So it's basically what it boiled down to. So he was in the stands the day in 1822. It was in November. For the first time after Eclipse had beaten the southern horses, a couple of these southern horses in the north, Eclipse came down to the south to race, or technically in the middle, but it was basically a southern jurisdiction, Washington, D.C., to race against a southern horse. The best horse in the south in 1822 was Sir Charles. And the Sir Charles's owner was this sort of cocky Virginian, and he issued a challenge, and Eclipse came down, and Sir Charles, I start the book with that race, and it was Sir Charles was injured several days before the race, and they went ahead and tried to run him anyway, and he broke down during the race, and it was a tragedy for the South. It was a hard humiliation. A lot of money had been bet sort of privately by these Southerners, and they lost, and so they were very humiliated, and it was the worst. The President of the United States, James Monroe, was Virginian and a horseman, and he was at that race. And so William Ransom Johnson is also at the race and says, this enough is enough. This is a low point. We need to beat this northern horse, and I'm going to take it on myself. And he was so preeminent that no one would dare. He sort of just took over, by fiat, sort of I'm in charge. And no one would ever say, well, maybe we ought to let someone down the road be in charge. If he wanted to be in charge, he was in charge. So, and he did negotiate the terms of a very, very agreeable terms to the South, I think. He was a very cunning guy in terms of he was a big gambler and sort of the psychology of the horse race and the horse people. Long before there was psychology, he knew sort of how to play these guys. And he knew that in the night of that race in Washington that the northern horseman would be sort of cocky. And the reality was Eclipse was 8 years old at that point, was getting up in years. And at not being the nuanced horseman that he was, he knew he could take advantage of the fact. He knew that Eclipse was getting old, and that with a young horse, he might have a chance to beat Eclipse. So he did negotiate the terms of a challenge, and the race. He agreed to run the race in the north because they had their new track up there just outside New York City. In exchange for that, he didn't have to name the horse that would run against Eclipse until the day of the race, really until post time, the day of the race, and he had 6 months to pick a horse. So, and that was quite an advantage, and he made the most of it.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Eisenberg. He's a sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun and has authored a newly published book that is the story of this race that we're here talking about. The title is The Great Match Race, When North Met South in America's First Sports Spectacle, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. John Eisenberg is a sports writer for the Baltimore Sun. He's written a number of books, and his most recent is The Great Match Race, When North Met South in America's First Sports Spectacle. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. We do have a caller here, someone to come into the conversation. Let's do that in Belgium, not too far away from where we are. Line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. Mm-hmm. As a young man, I used to deliver the Baltimore Sun. Thanksgiving was just like delivering an encyclopedia. God, that thing was terrible. On with it, Len. And you're being very well located there right next to Pimlico, right there in the racetracks. But the question I have, and I don't know that you've actually brought this up, and it's actually a couple questions. One was, if I remember right, way back in the day, horse races were much, much longer, and the horses were much, much bigger. They're like workhorses, practically. They're just big animals that went on and on and on forever. And today, the horses are still obviously big, but they're much more fleet of foot, and they're very fragile, like we saw this last weekend with this horse. And why did they go from being such a heavy-duty animal and then go to such a lightweight animal? Obviously, the speed is there, but when you spend $1 million for something, don't you want it to stand up?
Well, that's a great question, and you've touched on a key aspect of the book and the race and the American racing and everything involved with it. Really, you are right about the length. The great match race, we were just getting to that, was indeed a very, very long race. I think if racing fans today would not even believe it. Back then, they raced in heats. You had to win two heats. It was best 2 out of 3 heats in a match race. Basically, just separate races. So they would, and each heat was 4 miles.
Oh my!
So, not to give anything away, but the Great Match Race went 3 heats. So these horses raced 12 miles in an afternoon, and with about 30 minutes in between the heats. And you were right there. The breed itself was different. It was much sturdier, broader, and just a great deal more endurance, not as fast, but not slow either. They ran these 4-mile heats in about 8 minutes, sometimes well under. So 2-minute pace. Back then, not bad for just going round and round and round and round, which is what they did. It was a mile-long track, and they would just go round and round. So, yes, those horses were entirely different than what we would see today, and the reason is over a period of, we're talking well over a century here, that type of racing was eventually, it fell out of fashion. A lot of horsemen believed that it was brutal, that it was cruel to ask horses to race that far and even farther in some races. If you had a sweepstakes with, say, 8 horses and the first one to win 2 heats, it could take 5 or 6 heats, and they'd race 20-something miles. And so heat racing eventually fell out of favor in thoroughbred racing, and then the races themselves became much shorter. And racing fans liked speed. They liked to see it's much more exciting to see horses go fast. And the breeding of thoroughbred horses over a long period of time has followed after that need for speed, so to speak. And you have seen over decades of breeding that the horses have gotten not necessarily taller, a little taller and thinner. Their legs are like matchsticks. They're not nearly as thick. Their rumps aren't as big. They're just faster, sleeker animals. And with that comes, though, more fragility, as you mentioned, as we did see last Saturday, and as any horseman knows, you see from time to time. These horses are bred to race. They're bred to run fast, and they are fragile. And so it's a different creature these days.
The second question I was going to have is, you had this conflict between the North and South in these races. They were always after each other. But now, later on in horse racing, the conflict ended up being between California and the East Coast. Especially back towards the 30s, there was a real big hassle between the East Coast and the West Coast. It seems like there's always this friction between one group and another group in this sport.
Well, it's a very, what we saw, what the Great Match Race was about, is about the dynamic that makes for good sports events. And what is it? What makes for a good sports event is when people have an emotional investment in it. Whatever that emotional investment may be, and for a lot of people, it's often where they live. That's why when the Chicago Bears play the Baltimore Ravens, people get excited. It's my team, it's my city, it's my region, and the people that really got into the Great Match Race, it's really the first stirring of that in America that had never really happened before. The differences between people were played out in wars before that, in real bloodshed. And to sort of use sports as a metaphor had never even been considered. They didn't have sports, but to see it played out on a playing field or a horse track was something new. But yes, they did feel that way. And ever thus, in horse racing, as the power centers of horse racing have shifted in America just continuously. Pretty soon after this race, Kentucky began to exert its dominance in the Midwest, and and then New Orleans was really strong, and there were a lot of different places, and New York became very powerful, and then the South, which had been preeminent, sort of went on the wane as in, and took a lot of the horsemen from other places, and their horsemen went to other places, and so gradually they made it all the way out to the West Coast, and the weather being good, and it's a fertile ground for horse breeders out there, and so yes, the North South was sort of gone, but the East West, and it's still in play today. So there's always some sort of tension.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, my pleasure. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We sketched out how it is we come to the point of having this race, the Great Match Race, that there was this very successful Northern horse, had won a lot of races, had defeated a number of Southern horses, and that it was a matter of pride for the horse breeders of the South that they should be able to defeat this horse. And that this one man in particular, the Napoleon of the Turf, William Ransom Johnson, issued this challenge to Eclipse and to the owners of Eclipse and said, "We're going to have a race. You race against a Southern horse. I'll pick the horse. I won't tell you until the day of the race who the horse is going to be, but I'm going to pick the horse. We'll run it up there in the north, and we're putting some big money on this race." And it must, as much confidence as the owners and the trainer of Eclipse must have had based on the performance so far, they must have had reason to be nervous because they had no idea who they were going to race against. So they couldn't really think about strategy particularly. I mean, they didn't know anything. And, you know, who knows? Anything could happen in a race. Were they worried that maybe they had made a bet, in a sense, that they shouldn't have made?
Well, there are different levels of concern in the North. A lot of the Northerners were clueless about horse racing and the strategies, and they were sort of new to it. They were horse racing fans. Eclipse had made them horse racing fans, and they just assumed Eclipse would win. Eclipse always won. So there was a large segment of the sort of the casual fan just said, "Oh, well, we're going to race again. We're going to win. This will be fun." So they, and then there was a very small group, and the man who owned, there was a group of people who were sort of managing Eclipse. John Cox Stevens was an industrialist and actually invented the America's Cup in sailing years later. He was sort of the money man. And Cornelius Van Ranst was a sort of an old-line New York family and horse owner, one of the few horse owners. He owned Eclipse, and he trained Eclipse himself, and he was very concerned. He alone among the Northerners, and he would listen to these overconfident Northerners thinking, "Oh, Eclipse will win again." He had raced in the South. He was among those Southerners. As I said, the Northerners used to go down to the South to race their horses because it was the only place to have good racing, and he went down there and always got drummed. His best horses would lose, and he knew William Ransom Johnson, and he knew he'd seen his horsemanship firsthand, and he knew giving that guy 6 months to prepare a horse, any horse he wanted, to race, and he also understood the age differential, that Eclipse was 9 by the time this horse raced. He was very concerned, and actually, the night that the challenge was made in Washington, D.C., he felt that it should be turned down. "This is asking too much of my horse. He's old, he's done enough, and he's a great horse, and it's not fair." But he was outvoted, even though it was his horse, outvoted by the money people and the sheer commerce of it. So, and he spent 6 months sweating it out. He knew that it was going to be tough, that William Ransom Johnson was going to bring the full bore of his powers, and it was going to be tough.
In terms of, as we discussed maybe before this, the only thing that really existed in terms of a big spectator sport was, in fact, horse racing. But probably there had been nothing, that no race had attracted the kind of attention that this race did. And as you describe it, it sounds as if life in America almost came to a standstill.
Well, it did. Certainly nothing. No, the race in that I mentioned earlier in 1822, where Eclipse won down in Washington, and the president was there and all that, the sort of the impetus for the Great Match Race, there were between 6,000 and 10,000 people there for that, and that was considered a sprawling crowd. Everybody said, "Oh, my gosh, look at all these people that came to this horse race." And so when the Great Match Race was set, the terms were set, and it was going to be at this course in New York, they went through some additions and some expansion, expecting maybe a crowd like that, 10,000, they didn't know, anywhere 10 to 12,000, be something like that. Well, they were, no one saw coming what came, which was 60,000. The level of interest just increased. This is the first media-driven sports event in America. The New York newspapers really drummed it up and wrote about it for months, and the New York people got really behind their horse. And on the day of the race, 40,000 Northerners showed up. And on the day of the race, the Southerners, who were so determined to win, by the day of the race, 20,000 Southerners were in New York City. Just a huge... And to give you an understanding of what that is, I think the population of Delaware was 24,000 at that time. So this is almost the entire population of states picked up and moved to the south, from the south to the north. They came by stagecoach, by ferry boat, steamboat, however they could get there. Some of them just rode on their horses. But 20,000 people were there from the south, 40,000 from the north. Just an incomprehensible crowd, really, that there could be that size. Not even the kind of crowd when independence was won back in the 1780s or 1770s and 80s. There were no crowds like that to celebrate these things. Mm-hmm. So there'd been nothing like this before.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the race, promising that we will not reveal...
Okay.
We will not reveal the ultimate winner. For that, people are going to have to go out and take a look
right.
at the book.
Unlike Sports Illustrated, by the way, reviewed the book, which I was very grateful for, but they did give it away, which I wish they hadn't.
Well, so did I also, there was a nice review in the, a pretty good review in the New York Times, and I think they did too. But
yeah.
So if you don't want to know, don't go out and look at reviews.
Right.
As you explained, here it was the kind of racing was a little different than exists now. It was not just one race, winner take all. They raced in heats. It was a long race, 4 miles, and what the deal was, you won 2 out of 3. So what they did was they were going to go out and run one race, 4 miles. They're one winner. Then they get to rest half an hour. Then they go back and race another 4 mile race. And if the other horse won, then there would have to be a third deciding race. So that's an awful lot to put the animals through. We can talk, I guess we talk a little bit about the first two races, because indeed it was a case where Eclipse won the first race, and then the Southern Horse won second. So at the end of 3 races, it was tied.
It was actually reversed.
Oh, was it one? Okay. It was
yes.
Other way around. In any case, it was at the end of 2 races, it was one race apiece. So there was a third and deciding race. Maybe you could talk a little bit about them, what happened in the first two runs.
Well, the first two races, to prepare for the race, William Ransom Johnson selected about 5 or 6 finalists, basically, and went through a period of trials and of performance tests for months trying to decide which horse would race in New York. And he raced them against each other and against other horses, and he trained them endlessly. And really, it was like the Kentucky Derby, the prep season leading up to Kentucky Derby, where there's 20 races and they sort of knock each other out, and you see who's left gets to run in the big race. That's pretty much what he did. And he wound up settling on a 4-year-old horse by the name of Henry. Sir Henry was his name. They called him Henry. Sort of dropped the Sir. He was known as Henry. And he was brilliantly fast. And in the beginning of this 6-month trial period, he was not ready. He was precocious. He was not intelligent enough, or he was intelligent, but he was not hadn't been trained enough to sort of obey his jockey. So he was kind of wild. He was like a teenager, sort of in need of a little counseling. So Johnson gave him months and months of this, and he was probably ranked 3rd among the finalists. And by the end, though, he was the fastest, just brilliantly fast. So they name him the horse that day of the race, and he takes off. I mean, they line him up. There's 60,000 people there, and as you said, the whole country sort of, the New York Stock Exchange shut down, Congress shut down, all the politicians were there. Really, the country just came to a halt. So they take off, and the Northerners are fully expecting to win. Well, Henry just fires out, and Eclipse, I think, had never been behind in 7 races. So he spends the whole first 3.5 miles trailing. Henry's ahead the whole time, and Eclipse's owner, Cornelius Van Ranst, had changed jockeys just prior to the race, a fatal error. He had an old jockey by the name of Samuel Purdy, who he'd relied on for many years. And he felt like, well, with his old horse and this old jockey, we're just too old here. We need some youth. And he knew the Southern horse would be young. So he had a sort of an inexperienced jockey in his 20s. And the inexperienced jockey was shocked by Henry's speed and the tactics of the race. And so Henry's ahead the whole way, and Eclipse makes a run at the end, and Henry beats him. It's just he's unable to rally. So the South wins the first heat. Eclipse has never lost a heat, never been behind, and loses the first heat, which is like a funeral throughout the entire North. How could this horse have lost? So there's a great drama that plays out where they change jockeys. And they kind of go back to the one that they discarded and humbly ask, would you please come back on our horse? So after 30 minutes, they go back out for the second heat, and now in much better hands with the old experienced jockey. Henry still runs the second heat brilliantly and is ahead for the first 2 or 3 miles. And then there's a great move by Purdy, the jockey, and after all these miles of being behind, Eclipse finally takes the lead and wins the heat. So yes, after 8 miles they're tied, and it's just a great sort of ebb and flow, and the 60,000 people there going back and forth, the emotions and the noise. You can just imagine there've never been anything like it in America.
Purdy, the man who had been the jockey before, he must have known something that nobody else knew, because he came to the track dressed to run. He was wearing his racing silks there, and he was apparently sitting there and watching the first race when the Eclipse's owners came and said, would you mind riding the horse for us this time around?
Yes. A lot has been written about, and this is an event, by the way, it's been written about a lot in academic circles, and so you can imagine with all the social and political implications, it never received sort of the full bore, major narrative nonfiction that I did with it, but it's been written about and speculated about a lot. And there's been a lot of speculation about why he showed up in his silks. The reality is there was a fair amount of strategy in these match races and long races, and it was not infrequent to see a jockey, the people that sort of managed these horses, change jockeys in between heats. It did happen from time to time. And so, in this case, they did see that. I think Purdy sort of intuitively knew that they'd put this sort of callow youngster on the northern horse, and he loved the horse. He loved Eclipse, and that's, I think, the only reason why he came in his silks. I think he sort of intuitively knew he was an old horseman, that there could be trouble later in the day, and it could easily happen that I wind up riding. So I am going to come prepared, and as much as it sort of annoyed him, he kind of, there's a part of him that said, you know what, I should come in my pajamas or something and just forget it. You know, they fired me. They let's let them lose on their own. But his loyalty to the horse won out.
Yeah, well, and again, if people want to know how it came out, what the result was, you're going to have to go out and read the book, The Great Match Race, by John Eisenberg. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It is out now. We're coming down to, we have maybe about 5 minutes left, and I guess I was hoping you wouldn't mind if I asked you about something different, but that still has to do with horses and,
sure,
and horse racing, because I know that you've written some stories about Barbaro, the horse that won the Kentucky Derby and then was injured at the Preakness, and has been getting the story about the horse and the effort to save the horse to treat his broken leg so that then he could have a life, not a running life, but a life as a stud, has gotten a lot of play in the media. And one of the stories that you wrote here raises this question. I'm not sure it really answers the question, but raises the question about why it is that the media has devoted so much attention to the story. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a valid question. And in that story, I sort of, which I wrote for the Baltimore Sun, I sort of played two sides. I was listening to talk radio, and there was seemed to fall into 50-50 camp. Half the people just said, oh my gosh, what a horrible thing. And then the other people said, come on, it's just a horse. We got a lot of other things to be worried about, which surprised me a little bit. Because I think the majority reaction, anyone who saw that, I mean, it's an animal put into a race. And, of course, these thoroughbreds don't know any differently. They don't know to hold up or they just run as hard. Their desire to finish first or just to come in ahead of their other horse is it's instinctive. And so they just run as hard as they can until they're told not to. And so here's a horse that ran so hard that he broke his leg. And I think that's just sort of compelling to a lot of people. And you know, horses inspire people. That's why I write books about horses. I never cease to be amazed at people, see human qualities in them. Not necessarily that's not necessarily the right thing to do, but they do invest in these horses. They're just such pure competitors. As I said, they just want to run and win, that I think humans become attached to these horses, and they're inspired by horses, and that's why there have been so many horse books and movies, and people are fascinated by them. They're beautiful, big, fast creatures. And so I think that to see one break his leg and then to see the effort that is being made to save the horse, I think, is compelling to a lot of people. It's just the people that own him, fortunately, are very wealthy and are able to pay for it. So, because it's a huge expense and a lot of trouble, but I think people want to know, people don't want to see a horse just discarded. So I think there's something about it that moves people.
Yeah. Well, I guess part of what maybe makes the story interesting is that there would have been a time, and I think probably not that long ago, that a horse like that would just have been put down. There would have been no question, and now the vet medicine technology is to a point where they could think about treating the horse, and in the past, that just wouldn't have been an option.
That's correct. Like in medical science for humans, in veterinary science, there's been a lot of advancements made. And this horse comes out of surgery, he's put in hydrotherapy, and I think it's a fascinating story for people just to see the lengths that they're going to and the way that it's done, and the fact that the pastern, the bone was broken into 23 pieces.
Wow.
And there's 20 screws in the leg. And the level of sophistication and the lengths they're going to is just unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. So it's a fascinating. It's a human or an equine interest story. And there's a technological aspect to it I think is fascinating, and the compassion. I think you put all those things together, and the fact that this was a champion horse. I think that's why you have so much run in the media.
Yeah. Well, certainly as far as the owners are concerned, if the horse survives, there's the opportunity to make significant amounts of money on the stud fees. At the same time, I've heard some of the comments from, I think perhaps particularly it was Gretchen Jackson, one of the owners of the horse, saying, this is not about money.
No.
We love this horse. And I guess I have to, the way she says it, I guess I have to believe that really is what it is, that it's not about the stud fees.
No.
It is about the animal.
No, I think one misconception is that it is assured if he survives that he would be a stud. That is not assured at all, because, I mean, not to get too graphic, but a horse has to rear on its hind legs in order to breed to mares, and that's the way it's done from behind, and with a reconstructed ankle. That's 1,000 pounds or more going into the air that has to be supported by these ankles. And I immediately, as soon as that happened, horsemen were telling me, that is a terrible injury for a horse that wants to have a stud career. Many a horse have not been able to have stud careers because of damaged ankles.
Yeah, that's, I guess, what people need to understand. We were talking about thoroughbred horses. They got to breed the old-fashioned way. There's no artificial insemination with racehorses.
No, so he has to be able to stand and support his own weight in order to do this, and that is very iffy, to say the least. So it is true, Roy and Gretchen Jackson are not expecting that at all. I think that would be a pleasant surprise at this point.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's an interesting book. I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Our guest, John Eisenberg, he is a sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun. The book is The Great Match Race, published by Houghton Mifflin. And Mr. Eisenberg, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.